The pitch never happened in public. It happened in quiet rooms and private threads, where names carried weight and questions felt impolite. Everyone there shared the same credential. Everyone believed that meant safety. The story was simple and sharp. A hidden edge buried in insurance filings tied to one of the most respected financial empires on Earth. Not illegal, not flashy, just smarter than the market. Money moved fast because trust already existed. What investors did not see was where the money actually went. It did not sit patiently waiting for filings to unlock value. It chased risk. It chased time. When trades failed, explanations tightened. When accounts ran thin, new capital arrived. Old promises were paid with fresh checks. The math worked only as long as belief held. This is not a story about ignorance. These were educated professionals. This is a story about proximity to power, about how shared networks lower defenses, and about how one man learned that credibility could be leveraged harder than cash. Chapter 1. The Credential Trap. The room did not feel like a pitch room. It felt like a reunion that never ended. Conversations skipped introductions and went straight to familiarity. Names were exchanged with a shorthand confidence that assumed credibility. Degrees were implied, not questioned. This was the environment where trust arrived before evidence. At the center of it stood Vladimir Artemonov, presenting himself as someone who understood a corner of the financial world others overlooked. According to his own representations, he was a graduate of Harvard Business School. That detail mattered. It shaped how listeners framed everything that followed. The pitch did not rely on charts or long decks. It relied on alignment, same school, same circles, same unspoken rules. What Artemonov described sounded technical, but restrained. He spoke about insurance companies, regulatory filings, and how certain disclosures created predictable price movement when interpreted correctly. He pointed to companies linked to Berkshire Hathaway, not directly trading Berkshire itself, but entities operating in its orbit. The implication was careful. He was not promising inside information. He was promising better interpretation, a legal edge that required patience, precision, and experience. None of this was presented as speculative. The tone was measured, conservative even. He described the approach as methodical, almost boring, small inefficiencies repeated over time, low risk, consistent returns. The kind of strategy that appealed to professionals who already had exposure to volatility elsewhere and wanted stability here. This is what was claimed. What can be verified at this stage is more limited. Public records confirm Artemonov held himself out as a Harvard Business School graduate. Investors interviewed later said that the credential was central to their confidence. Several stated they did not perform independent verification of the strategy because the network itself felt like validation. In this environment, asking for proof felt like an accusation. Money began to move through private channels, not cold calls, not advertisements, referrals, alumni introductions, trusted intermediaries. Funds were wired into accounts controlled by entities associated with Artemonov. Investors believed they were buying exposure to a disciplined strategy rooted in regulatory insight. At this early point, there was no visible crisis. No one was asking for withdrawals. No one was questioning statements. Performance updates were provided, suggested positions were active and managed. Some investors reported receiving distributions that reinforced confidence. Those payments became evidence, even though their source was not scrutinized. It is important to separate what is known from what was later alleged. At this stage, there is no dispute that investor money was accepted. There is no dispute that Artemonov described a strategy involving insurance-related filings and Berkshire-linked companies. There is also no public record at this stage showing regulatory approval or independent validation of the strategy. That absence was not seen as a red flag. It was seen as discretion. The psychology of the room mattered more than the mechanics of the trade. This was not a mass market scheme. It was narrow by design. Exclusivity served two purposes. It limited exposure, and it amplified trust. Each new investor believed they were entering a controlled circle, not a funnel. Some investors later said they felt relief when they were invited. It felt like access, not risk. Others described a sense of responsibility, as if being part of the group meant maintaining confidence rather than questioning it. No one wanted to be the person who disrupted the harmony by asking for audits or third-party oversight. Artemonov's explanations leaned on complexity without dwelling in it. He spoke just enough to sound informed, then moved on. When asked how the filings translated into trades, he emphasized timing and structure but avoided specifics. That was framed as necessary confidentiality. Protect the edge, protect everyone. From a journalistic standpoint, this is where the story turns from finance to sociology. The claims themselves were not extraordinary. Markets are full of strategies tied to regulatory events. What was extraordinary was how quickly skepticism dissolved once credentials entered the room. At no point in these early interactions did Artemonov present himself as reckless. There were no promises of doubling money overnight. Returns discussed were modest but steady. That moderation became a shield. It disarmed the natural alarms that accompany exaggerated claims. Several investors later told investigators that they believed they were protecting themselves by staying within their network. They assumed bad actors operated outside elite institutions, not within them. The Harvard connection was not just a resume line. It was a signal of belonging to a system that policed itself. That assumption would later prove costly. Financial records examined by authorities much later would show a very different picture of how funds were deployed. But none of that was visible in the beginning. Early statements, where available, did not clearly disclose the use of options trading. There was no explicit warning about leverage or downside exposure. Investors believed their capital was being used in alignment with the described conservative approach. It is critical to note that at this stage, no criminal findings had been made public. The narrative was still intact. There were no complaints filed, no regulators knocking. The machine worked because nothing challenged it. The first destabilizing turn did not come from the market. It came from scale. As more money entered, expectations quietly shifted. The pressure to produce consistent outcomes increased. Maintaining distributions became as important as generating returns. Investors began to expect regular confirmation that the strategy worked. Silence was no longer acceptable. This is where the gap between story and reality, as later alleged, began to widen. According to later filings, the actual trading activity involved risky options positions that did not match the low-risk profile described to investors. Options are not inherently fraudulent. They are common tools, but they introduce volatility that contradicts claims of stability. Losses, when they occur, can compound quickly. Those losses were not immediately disclosed. Instead, confidence was maintained through continued communication and selective payouts. Investors who received money believed it was profit. They did not know, and had no reason at that time to suspect, that their payments might be sourced from other investor funds. This distinction matters legally and ethically. At this point in the story, the actions described remain allegations that would later be tested in court. What is proven is that investors were not informed of the full risk profile of how their money was being traded. What is alleged is that new capital was used to satisfy earlier obligations. The network itself delayed detection. Investors spoke to one another, but those conversations reinforced belief rather than challenged it. Everyone assumed someone else had done deeper diligence. In reality, no one had. The credential trap closed quietly. Trust replaced verification, familiarity replaced oversight, and the first clock began ticking unnoticed. By the time doubts surfaced, the structure was already under strain. But in this first phase, all anyone saw was alignment, access, and reassurance. The question was no longer whether the strategy worked. It was whether anyone was actually watching. Chapter 2, Plugging the Gaps. Pressure rarely announces itself. It arrives as a change in tone. Emails that once felt casual begin to sound rehearsed. Updates that were once optional become scheduled. What had been an easy confidence starts to require maintenance. Inside the operation, the demands shifted. The strategy that had been described as steady now had to perform under growing expectations. More capital meant more exposure. More exposure meant less room for error. Losses, when they occurred, no longer stayed contained. They accumulated. According to later regulatory filings, trading activity during this period diverged sharply from what investors believed was happening. Instead of conservative positioning tied closely to insurance filings, the accounts showed significant options trading. Options amplify outcomes. They can multiply gains, but they can also accelerate losses. When the market moved the wrong way, damage happened fast. Those losses were not communicated in real time. Investors continued to receive updates framed in general language. Volatility was mentioned, but only as a temporary condition. The core strategy was described as intact. Patience was encouraged. Confidence was projected. Behind the scenes, the math grew tighter. Options positions require liquidity. When trades move against the holder, margin pressure follows. Capital that was expected to sit idle becomes necessary just to keep positions open. According to allegations later outlined by authorities, this is where new investor funds became critical. Money that arrived later did not always go where investors assumed. Instead of being deployed solely into new trades aligned with the promised strategy, funds were allegedly used to cover obligations created by earlier losses. Payments to some investors continued. Withdrawals, when requested, were honored selectively. This created the illusion of stability. From the outside, nothing looked broken. There were no missed payments, no public complaints. Investors who spoke among themselves often reassured one another by pointing to distributions they had personally received. Each successful payout reinforced the belief that the system worked. This is how the structure held. The pressure increased when some investors began asking more specific questions. Not accusations, clarifications. They wanted to understand timing, exposure, risk. These were reasonable inquiries, but they disrupted the flow. Each answer had to balance reassurance with concealment of volatility. Explanations became more complex. References to market timing replaced earlier claims of predictability. The language shifted subtly. Returns were no longer framed as steady. They were framed as strategic. Still, the core story remained unchanged. The edge existed. The filings mattered. The network was safe. According to investigators, internal records would later show that performance reports provided to investors did not always align with actual trading results. Discrepancies appeared between reported balances and account activity. These inconsistencies did not surface immediately because access to raw data was limited. This was not an open fund with third-party administrators. Oversight remained internal. Trust substituted for transparency. The moment the operation crossed from fragile to unstable came when withdrawal requests began to overlap. One investor asking for funds can be managed. Several asking at once creates exposure. Liquidity that might have covered one obligation could not satisfy many. At this stage, according to allegations, the operation relied increasingly on incoming capital to stay functional. New money was not simply fuel for growth. It became a stopgap, a way to delay reckoning. Legally, this distinction is central. Using new investor funds to pay earlier investors without disclosure is a defining feature of a Ponzi-style structure. Authorities would later allege that this is precisely what occurred during this phase. Artemanov has denied wrongdoing, and the matter would ultimately be addressed through the courts. At this point in the timeline, no public enforcement action had yet taken place. Inside the network, however, something had changed. Conversations grew quieter. Some investors stopped referring friends, not out of suspicion, but out of discomfort. The ease was gone. The certainty had thinned. The structure depended on continued belief. But belief is fragile once it requires effort. The more energy spent maintaining confidence, the more visible the cracks become. Documents later reviewed by regulators suggest that by this point, losses were significant. Options positions had moved sharply against expectations. Recovering those losses would have required extraordinary gains. That did not happen. Instead, communication intensified. Calls were scheduled, reassurances repeated, the narrative tightened. Everyone was urged to stay calm. The strategy needed time. Time was the one resource running out. What made this phase particularly dangerous for investors was that outward signals still suggested functionality. Money moved. Statements arrived. Silence would have triggered alarm. Activity created cover. Some investors who attempted partial withdrawals were paid promptly. That was not generosity. It was necessity. Each successful withdrawal reduced the likelihood of panic spreading through the network. Each satisfied investor became proof that nothing was wrong. This dynamic delayed intervention. From a systemic perspective, this is how trust networks fail slowly. They are designed to amplify confidence, not detect deception. Shared credentials discourage scrutiny. Social cohesion suppresses whistleblowing. Everyone assumes someone else has visibility. By the time suspicion began to crystallize, it was no longer theoretical. It was practical. Investors wanted answers they could verify. They wanted documentation. They wanted independent confirmation. According to later complaints, those requests were met with resistance or delay. Explanations emphasized confidentiality and strategy protection. Requests for third-party audits did not move forward. This marked the reversal. What began as a question about performance became a question about truth. The story that once felt solid now felt evasive. The edge that had justified secrecy now demanded it. The structure could not absorb both transparency and survival. One had to give. As pressure mounted, the possibility of exposure expanded beyond the network. Financial institutions involved in processing transactions had visibility into patterns investors did not. Regulators monitor unusual activity even when participants do not complain. At this point, the collapse was no longer a question of if. It was a question of sequence. The machine continued to run, but it was overheating. Every new dollar carried weight. Every delay increased consequence. Every reassurance raised stakes. The gaps were no longer theoretical. They were financial, and they were growing. By the end of this phase, containment had failed. What had been managed privately was moving toward public reckoning. The belief that the network could absorb the damage was about to be tested. Chapter 3. When the network breaks, exposure does not arrive as a single moment. It arrives in layers. First comes awareness, then confirmation, then consequence. By the time the final layer appears, the outcome is already set. The first visible shift came when outside scrutiny replaced internal reassurance. Financial institutions flagged activity patterns that no longer fit ordinary investment behavior. According to public records, regulators began examining account movements, trading activity, and representations made to investors. This was no longer a private matter managed through relationships. It had crossed into formal review. Once regulators step in, control changes hands. Investigators reconstructed the flow of money using bank records and brokerage data. Unlike investors, regulators did not rely on summaries or explanations. They followed transactions line by line. What they saw, according to later filings, did not match the story investors had been told. Options trading appeared repeatedly. Losses were substantial. The conservative strategy described in pitches was not reflected in the actual activity. More critically, funds from later investors were traced to payments made to earlier ones. This pattern was documented through timestamps, transfers, and account balances. These findings moved the case from suspicion to structure. At this stage, the distinction between allegation and proof narrowed. Regulators rely on documentation, not narrative. Where records showed money entering and exiting in ways inconsistent with disclosures, the explanation burden shifted to the operator. Investors learned about the investigation unevenly. Some heard through official notices, others through rumors. A few discovered it only when payments stopped. The network that once transmitted confidence now transmitted fear. Calls replaced emails, silence replaced updates. For many investors, the realization came with a sense of disbelief rather than shock. Looking back, some said the signs had been there. Others said they could not reconcile what they now knew with what they had believed. The betrayal felt personal, not just financial. Court filings later outlined the scope of the losses. The numbers ran into the millions. These were not abstract figures. They represented retirement savings, business capital, education funds. For some, the damage extended beyond money. Professional relationships fractured, reputations suffered, trust eroded. Artamonov's response, as reflected in public records, did not include an admission of fraud. Defense filings challenged interpretations of intent and strategy. The legal process focused on whether misrepresentations were knowingly made and whether investor funds were deliberately misused. That process is slow by design. It unfolds through motions, hearings, and evidence review. While the courts examined intent, investors confronted impact. Recoveries, where possible, depended on remaining assets. In cases like this, the math rarely favors victims. Once funds are lost through trading or recycled to others, there is little left to reclaim. Distribution, when it occurs, is partial. the network that once amplified trust now amplified accountability. Alumni connections that had opened doors became conduits for warning. Quiet conversations turned into formal statements. What had been handled discreetly could no longer remain so. Beyond the individual case, regulators frame the matter as a cautionary example. Elite credentials do not replace oversight. Closed networks do not eliminate risk. In some cases, they magnify it. This is the broader lesson investigators emphasized. Fraud does not require ignorance. It requires misplaced confidence. It thrives where skepticism feels socially costly. The final cost extended beyond court outcomes. Investors described a lasting reluctance to trust peer-based opportunities. Some withdrew entirely from private investments. Others imposed strict verification standards that strained relationships. The damage to social capital was real. The network broke not because credentials failed, but because they were treated as safeguards instead of signals to verify. Trust became the currency, and it was spent without accounting. In the end, the case was not defined by complexity. It was defined by simplicity. Money went in, losses occurred, new money covered old obligations. Disclosure did not match reality. That is the structure regulators recognize. The story closed without redemption. There was no dramatic reversal, no last-minute recovery, only documentation, consequences, and aftermath. Trust did not fail by accident. It was engineered.